Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things broadcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwoods.
Hey, yeah, right on. We got two Brian Brushwoods. One by the name of Brian Brushwood.
I was about to say his good friend Justin Robert Young.
Oh, barely made it. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm good. As I said, I'm Andrew Main. That's Justin you just heard, and that's Brian sipping a SpaceX drink right now.
Sure am, man. Occupy Mars. It's the hot new brand. Everyone's wearing it.
Occupy Mars. That's right. I'm wearing my SpaceX shirt right now.
Do you know how I can tell you're wearing SpaceX clothes? Because
that's all
you're
I wear
dressed.
Now.
Because your name is Andrew Main.
Yeah, it's unpredictable. I'm Homer Simpson that way. Gentlemen, I don't know where to begin.
Yeah, are you all right? You seem a little like flushed. You look frothy, like fresh milk from a sexy cow.
You know, I'm a man at adventure, and I set out to do things like I found Monkey Island. I'm not bragging, but I found Monkey Island.
As one does, yeah.
Yeah, you explore the wild terrain of Burbank.
Yeah, another attempt with Captain Loogie, we found a submarine in the middle of a forest, you know. Probably not a narco sub. Maybe could be. Not saying it was or wasn't, but anyhow.
Yeah.
We were in search of monkeys. And I could go on about all my different adventures and things I just do for you guys, really. I'm not a thrill seeker. I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I just want information. I want to bring it back here. And on a previous podcast, we talked about Mars and lava tubes, the idea that if you wanted to colonize Mars, the deeper you go in, the more earth you have and rock between you and the surface, the more protected you are from radiation. And short of building habitats and just covering the dirt, another option is to have tunnels. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we talked about from branding perspective, we wanted to call them Martian canyons so that you could just have lush green life all around you and a blue sky up above.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I was curious about this whole lava tube thing and I decided to do some exploring.
I am utterly intrigued because absolutely nothing would surprise me.
I think this would be a good time to let all the audio listeners know that if Andrew's audio seems different, it's because he is not. At least presumably sitting in front of his computer in sunny LA. He is somewhere else. His normal SpaceX attire is covered by a very sporting jacket.
He looks very Bear Grylls-ish. I feel like maybe he just came back from slaying an elk or something.
Yeah.
And then drinking his own urine.
It looks very, very, very rugged. So, Andrew, where are you and what have you been doing?
But gentlemen, I'm going to get to the where I am right now in a moment. I gotta get to that point, but I got to get where I've been and where I barely survived. So, I want to explore a lava tube. I wanted to see firsthand what a lava tube would look like. I've been one since a boy. You know, as a boy, I was a big explorer, exploring all kinds of things. Like, yeah, sure, my dad brought me there, and my brother, and my mom, and all that. But really, I was the one, the driving force behind that. Not to take anything away from them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like they had already been there before you. I mean, you were probably leading the pack from the beginning.
Or you know, holding up the rear, exploring. You know. You know, mom, sometimes it becomes so overcome with emotion, it looked like tears. But anyhow, let's not get into my childhood.
Exactly, yeah.
So I thought, you know what? I want to go to a lava tube. I want to see a lava tube and see what a lava tube would be like, you know, as an adult to explore for possible building, you know, a Mars colony inside of one. All right?
Yeah.
So I came all the way to Oregon at a colleague here, and she said, hey, let's go explore a cave. Let's go explore a lava tube. I said, precisely. I said, that's exactly what I wanted to do. And so we went to Washington, and we're driving to this cave, and then I find out that it's a lava tube. I do some research on it. I'm like, fantastic, because this just meshes completely with what I want to do, the research for Mars. And we're driving to this lava tube, and a lava tube is neat. These things can be formed very, very rapidly. You have volcanic eruptions come, and then lava pours through underground, creating a vast tunnel. This was part of the network of lava and volcanic activity that formed Mount St. Helens, which I survived that Mount St. Helens explosion back when that happened, by the way, as a boy.
I mean, I'm sure you did it through your grit and vinegar.
Yeah. I mean, millions of other people lived in the area too, but I like to think that, you know, it was my example, you know.
Nobody needs to minimize the survivor experience, you know, like everybody's got their own story, and yours is as valid as the next one.
When I walked out on the street and I saw, you know, a layer of ash on the car, you know, it looked like doomsday. But again, having gone through that, decided to brave forward, move forward, and go explore a lava tube, which at any moment, knowing that hot lava could burst through that tube and fill it with lava, making it really a lava tube. But I wanted to explore it for the Weird Things audience, right?
So you found a lot. I didn't know that you could just readily find those on Yelp.
Well, here's the thing, is you can find lava tubes, but this is where it gets weirder, gentlemen. It gets weirder, all right? Bear with me. So we're driving to the location of this lava tube, and my colleague is, you know, navigating as I survey the environment, the area around us. And then I said, you know, what's the name of the this area, by the way, we're looking for? And she says, you know, it's called Abe Cave. I'm like, oh, Abe Cave. Okay, and we're driving along. I'm like, A-B-E? She goes, no. Ape. A-P-E. Cave.
Ape,
like,
cave. Ape, like, cave.
And now we're in, and it's getting darker now. We started off later in the day because I'm a nocturnal animal, and sometimes it takes me, you know, I my senses are the highest during that time of point.
By which you mean you're the most not currently sleeping by that time?
Perhaps. So
there's a lot
driving
of complicating
along.
Factors.
We're getting into, the trees are extremely tall. We're driving through the forest. We're in the middle of Washington, the middle of who knows where. And I realized this is actually near a location that I had in my book, Angel Killer.
What?
And now, I know. I'm like, wow, this is familiar to me. I'm like, oh, yeah, I looked at this on Google Earth, and I kind of know where we are roughly. But anyhow, we're driving through this. No cell phone reception. So the cell phone bars start to die, right?
Yeah.
So But before we go there, I do a little bit of last-minute research on where we're headed. Ape Cave sounds like an unusual name for a cave, doesn't it?
It certainly sounds unusual. It also, to the ears of Weird Things listeners, there are certain kinds of apes that have become very well known to those you know, who have followed this podcast for a while. So my chest right now, just listening to you, is starting to tighten a little bit.
So I look up Ape Cave, and I find out that Ape Cave was named for a group of an exploring club. They call themselves the Apes. But why did they call themselves the Apes? And I start to dig a little bit deeper and find out that there nearby is a place called Ape Canyon. So I ask my colleague, I ask my escort, I said, so why is this called Ape Cavern and Ape Canyon? She goes, oh, somebody was attacked by an ape here a long time ago, or apes.
I said,
really? I look up and I find out that Ape Cave near Ape Canyon gets its name from one of the most famous Bigfoot attacks ever, where a group of miners in like the 1920s claimed that a pack of wild apes threw rocks at them and assailed them, and they had to kill one of them before barely getting away.
Wow. Wow. I'm looking at images right now of Ape Cave. Is this the place
That's
that you
it?
Went to?
Yeah.
That looks pretty dark and ominous.
This
and
looks terrifying.
The only thing scarier than this cave is the thought that it's crawling with malicious saber-toothed apes.
Just for those of you who are only listening to this, this is like a Guillermo del Toro kind of like twisted evil curves. It is horrifying.
So this is the center of Bigfoot country. This is the center of Bigfoot country that I find out that I'm going into a cave. Its name came from the explorers who then took their name from one of the most famous Bigfoot incidents there are. And there is some skepticism as to that event, that perhaps it was a bunch of teenagers throwing rocks at the miners that caused the altercation. Who's to know?
Technically still apes, man. The most dangerous game is what I call them.
Absolutely. Now we're going there, and I understand now as we're heading there, it's already 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which means nightfall is coming closer. We come up to a road that is blocked, a blocked road. There's a big metal bar across it that's like, don't go any further. You're crazy to go any further. Just go back. Go away. You don't belong here, right? You see in the upper right corner, there's an image of an ape in a cave. Pretty much exactly what could have been there at any moment. We parked, and I'm like, hey, let's keep going. She's like, are you sure? I'm like, no, let's go. Let's be brave about it. I mean, the conversation, the roles may have been reversed.
Ah, okay.
Who's to say? Who's to say? But anyhow, somebody acted very
bravely.
Heat
of the moment, heat of battle. You know, it's hard to keep an eye on it.
Now understand, it's about to be nightfall, and we have the chance to go into a cave that's well over a mile long that goes into the deep bowels of the earth, knowing that when we emerge, it will be complete darkness, and we'll be in Bigfoot country in earshot of one of the most horrific, violent Bigfoot attacks in history. Turn around? Do I say, let's get back in the car and go back to the safety
probably.
And comfort?
I mean, that would seem to be a realistic thing to say, but I don't think so. Andrew, I think that you were brave and bold and you sallied forth.
We did. We descended the stairs into the depths of this dark, dark, labyrinthian environment. I mean, some people would say because the lava tube is a completely straight line, you can't really call it a labyrinth. But when, you know, it's dark in there.
Sure.
Hey, look, man, we're not grading the difficulty of the maze.
I mean, like, mind plays tricks on you. You know, man. The dark's a funny thing.
Yeah.
So we marched forth. We sallied forth throughout there. And you know, somebody complained because they were wearing Converses, which weren't the best shoes to, you know, trek in.
Some people.
Not going to name names. It's not important who did that.
It didn't matter.
Who complained.
Sounds like somebody was a real handful to explore with.
You know, maybe somebody on the surface kind of bitches and moans and complains, but really enjoys it nonetheless.
Oh, I mean, listen, the spirit of adventure burns strong, but sometimes the adventure that person might be used to going on is going to Pink's Hot Dogs.
Well, I'm just saying that, like, maybe when you're, you know, you get it. You know, it was an unexpected trip, which was delightful. So I didn't get to pack all of my complete gear. In fact, I just wore a pair of Converse with no treads on
his
the bottom.
Your go bag wasn't available at the time. Your workout bag.
No.
Yeah. All right.
So we marched down into the cavern. And what's amazing is you get down into there and you look up and the ceiling is like 30 or 40 feet above you. And it's a large, large space that just goes on and twists around for well over a mile long. And you have to think that in all seriousness now, Mars is going to be riddled with lava tubes. We've seen from satellite images, we've actually seen 30 meter across holes in the ground that go into vast deep shafts that go underneath there. So we know that there's just looking at from the surface, we can see these things. There's who knows what's going to be around it, particularly when you get around some of the more volcanic area. And remember, the largest volcano in the solar system is Olympus Mons.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, which is on Mars. So
did it I would have to imagine that it significantly colored your experience, like after our lava tube Martian Canyons talk. Like, do you feel like you could live your life just in Ape Cave?
I'm the guy that says I'm not going to Mars until there's a Taco Bell. I would say that what you look at that, you realize that would be a good place to start from, and then from there you could be tunneling out into different directions.
How many miles long is Ape Cave?
I believe about a mile and a half.
Man, dude, that so roughly Manhattan is three miles long, right?
I think it's like more like seven or so.
Okay, all right.
Is it? I don't know. I could be mistaken.
San Francisco is 7x7.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so here's the way I think that, you know, what you would do is you'd take a mile and a half cavern, which would take a lot of oxygen to fill. So what you might do is you might start at the very, very back of it, put an airlock, and then as you can produce oxygen, whatever, to fill it, keep moving that forward and forward and forward until you have the whole thing filled. And then you would start tunneling sideways and in different directions and creating subdivisions. But you would start at one natural structure to build from.
By the way, Manhattan is 2.5 miles wide, and it's 13 miles long. So I was thinking of the width, not the length.
I was wrong too. But anyhow, but you get an idea that you could start building with, you know, boring machines, things like that, which you could do. And you start thinking, what would you want to build? How would you want to live in a lava? You know, you don't want to live in a lava tube and feel like, I'm in a lava tube. You would build skylights, fiber optics, whatever, bring as much light in. You would put rivers or streams in the middle of it. You would plant trees. You would do that. Your houses, you know,
about getting natural sunlight in there. I guess it would be worth it if you had, let's say, in fact, you could gather more sunlight, natural sunlight from the surface than condense it essentially. So you get Earth-like levels of bright sunshine from a Martian level of solar activity.
Yeah, you could build solar farms there too, and you could probably by that point digitally create a really, really good effective light. But yeah, there are a lot of things you could do, and I think you would try to build environments that would feel like the Shire from The Hobbit or something. You would have different regions. You'd want to create it. I think you'd want to make it more green than Earth.
Yeah,
I think you that would be the goal. Is it so
or,
that you're there,
or at least a more green than urban Earth? You know, like the cities that we live in right now.
Yeah. So. Any event, that was one thing that was going through my mind, though. So it would be cool to get, like, I'd love to, you know, can anybody out there knows where we can buy a lava tube? We'll put up a Kickstarter and we'll create Mars Camp there.
Can you imagine?
Would Ape Canyon, like, would, I mean, obviously you can't do it because it's a public park, but.
Well, there's
like,
Ape Canyon, then there's Ape Cave.
Sorry, Ape Cave. Would that be something, like, you see that and you're like, you want to know what? We could do Mars Camp and something like this?
There are bigger lava tubes in longer lava tubes, you know, and that's a national park, but I got to imagine they're probably privately owned lava tubes.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, that is something that you see the future that we could do something rad. Like,
yeah, I
in
think
something
so.
Like that, in a structure that bears a resemblance to that.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I think you could build something very cool to give people an idea. What would it be like? You know, what would living and working in there be like? How would you do recreation? How would you fit in there? And you can have bigger, wider spaces, but the idea to have something to start from that's already underground that you could, because if you wanted to have a structure on Mars, you're gonna have to have a lot of thick radiation shielding, not including what you need to keep your air inside.
Yeah.
But if you're building inside of a cave, you can have things that are, you know, super thin, aluminum walls, whatever, and just to hold your air inside before you are able to pressurize the environment.
Did we already talk about the fact that your vision of the Martian canyons is pretty well depicted in The Wrath of Khan when they go to Genesis Phase 1,
yeah,
and they're inside the asteroid?
I think we made a comment, like, yeah, we made a minor, you know, quip about that. The idea of the Genesis Cave is kind of like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
what the future
but can,
would be.
Can
yeah.
you imagine, though, like, you carve out, let's say, like a big, you know, arboretum or whatever. Can you imagine the trees that you could grow in Martian gravity, like just mm-hmm. unbelievably tall or, you know, super thick vines going up the side? Like, you could, I guess they could be attached at the top and go all the way down to the bottom and look like the redwoods.
We don't know how fast things will grow. You know, we might find that things grow much faster because of, you know, Earth plants might grow much faster because of less in gravity, or it might grow unpredictably. We don't know. All the more reason to start building. You know, there have been proposals too to try to build, like, let's say, a space station that could have Mars-like gravity. You know, because you just spin it to enough to give you that. And there's that's in a very, very exciting area that we live in now, that which we can realistically talk about doing these things, assuming that I ever made it out of Ape Cave, which
for all we know, they replaced you with a replicant.
Well, go ahead.
Well, do we have any best guesses on how much gravity you need to treat your bones right? Because that's the biggest problem with being in space for prolonged activity right now, is that your bones literally start to, you know, disintegrate.
I don't know. I mean, some is better than nothing. And, you know, one of the things they try to do is they have, you know, astronauts do effectively like resistance training to try to keep putting pressure on there. And a third gravity might be fine. You know, a third gravity might be fine. And then, of course, that's going to mean going to the gym is going to be interesting because, you know, you're going to be benching 1,000 pounds if you're a weightlifter.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine that? That's amazing.
Yeah. Bro, do you even lift over 1K?
Yeah. Of course, you still have to deal with inertia and these other things on the joints, which will be, you know, still there. But it'll change up. There's so many areas it's going to be fascinating to try to figure out what will happen. So we reach the end of Ape Cave, right? And I saw some things there that were still can't quite wrap my mind around it. Little holes in the wall where you'd see little things glistening back at you, tiny, tiny glowing flecks of light.
Oh, wait.
You know?
Were these bats? Bat's eyes or something?
I didn't see any bats. No, I saw like, you know, weird mineral substances, things like that. There's this rock, they call it the boulder, the meatball, whatever, which perilously dangles over your head. As I walked through there and I looked up above me, I saw this thing and narrowly jumped out of the way before it stayed perfectly still.
Yeah. Before it might have fallen right on you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, any moment, really. It is a hanging death trap.
Now, you'll see many photos if you look this up, and you'll see people wearing miners' helmets and protective gear. Nay, did I wear any of that?
Wow.
Well, you didn't have your go bag, right? You know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, hey,
But also, he lives dangerously. I mean, he's a real rough rider, this one.
he's a real rough bloke.
Yeah, here's a photo of me as I'm prepared to enter into. That's the Ape headquarters right outside there. You can see the look of concern on my face.
Oh, dude, no, I don't see any concern.
Well, that's the face of a man who's ready for anything.
Yeah.
You know, that's the big part about that is you know, there's no way that anyone's going to get the drop on you.
Now, the following items are prohibited in...
In Ape Cave, bananas?
Smoking, pets, food, alcohol, fires, or fireworks, which there go three of my defensive techniques right off the bat there.
you keep probably a good thing you left your go bag at home.
keep a bunch of Roman candles duct taped together on you at all times, Gatling gun style.
Dude, if I could. Now, I went inside there and I saw there were these shiny little rocks that look like stripper glitter.
Yeah. Okay. Take your word for that.
Okay.
Yep.
And then I tried to take another photo of them, and I can't explain what happened there, gentlemen, but it looked almost terrestrial. And I was reminded of the story, A Princess of Mars.
Yeah.
And how the passageway to Mars was found in a cavern.
Oh, so you're like, you know, half ready. You're like, am I ready to take on my destiny to save a race of green bear-breasted
As I remember, right, it was a cave in the American Southwest. So maybe a little bit geographically there, but who knows how these kinds of passageways.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know they only made one cave. I didn't know the rules, Justin.
I'm saying, who knows how these passageways evolve over time, you know?
Also, minor quibble, it was a work of fiction. But I'm just throwing that out. I don't mean to ruin
everything. Wait. Was it, Brian?
It didn't claim to be. You're right. It claimed to be the true account of what's his name on Barsoom.
So, as I journeyed further into this cavern and explored it and looked for any signs of ape, I didn't see any obvious signs of it, but I had the sense that we were being followed. I had the sense that somewhere near us, there could be a presence there.
Was
that
it a
was
family?
Stealthily.
From Ohio? Pardon me? Was it a family from Ohio behind you?
No, Brian. There was utterly nobody else in the cave besides us.
Really?
There was a couple people. There's one patch, the lower cave and the higher cave. I said, let's go to the lower cave.
Yeah.
Even though the higher cave is supposed to be more dangerous, I said, no, we're doing the lower cave because that just sounds lower. Yeah. The higher cave, there was a party ahead of us that went down the steps and went to the higher cave, and that was it. We were the only ones in there.
Really?
That's got to be awesome.
So no other brave explorers, no tittering teenagers trying to convince each other to not be a prude?
Nope. Just me and my colleague, and we made it. Understand, you start walking and walking and walking, and you're a mile underground, you know, obviously. And I checked just to be sure, iPhone don't work down there.
Now, did you, whenever I could tell, like, I'm about to be signal free, I always put it in airplane mode because I'm afraid of running out of battery in the meantime. Did you do that?
I threw caution to the wind and didn't.
He too likes to live dangerously. Yeah.
So as we're down there, I'm thinking it was a 20-minute walk from our car to the entrance of the cave. And then the car was half an hour away from civilization, from cell phone signal. So should one of us tripped and fell and split open our head inside the cave, it's when you start to think like, man, we're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, like
dude, Michael Crichton wrote this essay talking about how nature's really not your friend and really actively wants to kill you. And he talks about how he was hiking in the Himalayas, and there's maybe a 3 foot wide, 3 foot deep channel of water, and they lay out all the safety gear and they act like it's the biggest freaking deal in the world to walk across this 3 feet of water. And he's like, I don't understand what's the big deal. They're like, well, let's say you slip and you fracture your ankle. It's a 1 day hike to the nearest village for us to go ask for help. And then we have to go to the nearest city. Then we have to send out a helicopter. You're looking at 2 to 3 days you have to survive. And if you have a compound fracture, that's 2 to 3 days with a bone sticking out of your skin. It's like when you're cut off, it's like, man, are we soft and squishy and dumb?
Oh, God. Yeah. No, we are the worst.
Well, we reached the end of the cavern, and we saw some suspicious writings and markings there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they may have looked like graffiti, the untrained eye. Perhaps they looked, to me, they looked like a lesser mind
But some form of intelligence trying to express itself.
Yeah, trying to understand the rudimentary structures of speech, trying to write things, and described very carnal things, by the way, which you would assume that a Neanderthal, which really, if we talk about Bigfoot and all that, that's who I think we're really talking about, would be describing, you know, acts they would like to perform upon each other or acts they've seen perform, whatever.
It was a biology lesson.
Anatomy. Yeah, but it was.
Well,
it was
I think more statements of power and dominance, and and you know that kind of showboating to show that they're the best. They're the best.
and then very primitive, you know, hearts drawn with names inside them, which you know are would appear to be crude, you know, handwritten names, which would imply some sort of ritualistic ceremony took place there. So I saw all the signs of a primitive culture that you know inhabited that, and maybe quite recently, and then hid. Although it looked like there was no place to hide, who am I to say? There were upper chambers you could see, which looked like they could, you know, go off into other places. We reached the end, and then we hiked back. We made our way back to the end of the cavern. And I always had this thought, you know, thinking of, you know, John Carter and the idea of going into a cave and coming out into another world. And then when I had a chance later on, when we did reach the surface, it was nightfall. It was dark, but I fearlessly led us to safety with flashlights and maybe following behind, but protecting the rear. Nonetheless, something felt different. Something didn't quite feel the same. I wasn't sure what it was. And then I started reading the reports of the Ape Canyon attacks. And the man who survived them said that he thought that perhaps these apes that attacked him were interdimensional beings.
Really?
Huh.
That maybe through some sort of John Carter-esque portal, there emerged these ne'er-do-well beings that were tossing rocks and injured him and his companions.
Well, and that's not, it's rumored that that's why you don't find any Sasquatch bodies, is because upon death they return back to their dimension.
It's entirely, the word possible, gets thrown around perhaps a little bit too liberally. It is entirely something somebody would say or think. All I'm going to tell you this is that before I was about to log on here and was thinking about the story and where does this end, I wasn't quite sure because am I still in the middle of the story? Is it still taking place? And then something happened.
Uh-oh.
That give me a moment here. I'm going to try not to lose the connection, but if I can send this, I should have done a screenshot for you.
Ladies and gentlemen, live right now on the Weird Things podcast, you're seeing true adventure with the indomitable spirit of Andrew Main, who fearlessly went to the center of the earth, braved the possibility of interdimensional Sasquatches to search for you, and he's bringing us live firsthand accounts of the unusual things that happened afterwards.
Moments ago, gentlemen, when it was time to begin this broadcast and I'd relate to you the story, and there are many other little things, details that happened, which you'll be able to read in my novel, I Survived Ape Canyon.
Yeah.
As I go to log on and reading the stories about the interdimensional experiences of the miner who survived that ape attack in that very region that I bravely, bravely trekked into, I did a speed test to see how fast my Wi-Fi access was here.
Of course you would. Yeah, now that you have connection, we got to know how fast it is.
And this is where it gets a little bit weird, and I could sound dismissive.
Brace yourselves. Hold on to your butts.
When you do a Wi-Fi thing, it tells you what area that you're connecting through. It tells you what region, right?
Yep.
And I did a Wi-Fi check to see where my Wi-Fi, how fast my access was, and a location came up that was nowhere near me, that was many, many miles away, okay? That is over an hour away by car, but the city came up on my Wi-Fi and said, oh, this is your internet access. This is who's connecting you right now.
And
I immediately recognized the city. I immediately recognized it. And my heart stopped, gentlemen. My heart stopped. I began to palpitate and realized that perhaps I could still be back inside that canyon, that this all could be illusory, that perhaps this is not real. Or it is real, but in a way that I cannot describe.
What did it say?
Andrew, where is that city?
McMinnville, Oregon. Type in McMinnville, Oregon.
I want you to know, both audio and video listeners, I didn't have the cameras cut over. So there's this moment you say McMinnville, and then like as if we're in a movie, Justin and I slow pan to each other and are like, McMinnville? Like, wait, what?
Type in McMinnville, and then these three letters. UFO. The most famous UFO sighting there is. The classic McMinnville UFO sighting.
Photographs were taken near McMinnville, Oregon in 1950. The photos were reprinted around the world, and I'm looking at them right now. They are indeed a floating object in what is the gray landscape of rural McMinnville.
I'm nowhere near there, but some reason that popped up on my wife. That said, this is the location. This is the location that we're routing all of your communications information through. Oh, yeah, it happens to be the sighting of a UFO.
I mean, I don't want to jump straight to crying conspiracy, but you tell me that it's just a coincidence? You tell me this just happens? I mean, come on. Somebody's got to ask questions.
Brian, I don't know what the answer is. I know that I would have been dismissive a few days ago about Bigfoot attacks, and then I was there in the presence of a place. The people said these things took place.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, I mean, you can verify Ape Cave is a real place. And for all those people who are saying that the whole thing's made up, you want to explain to me where Andrew's been all day?
Yeah. I mean,
technically, I was at Oregon City today.
It was Friday that I was there.
But yeah.
And now rooting through a hub of UFO, well-known and documented UFO activity.
You're just going to tell us it's all coincidence?
With a near 70-year history?
Oh, I'm sorry, officer. You're just going to... let's just all go back to sleep and watch American Gladiators. I get it. All right, fine.
Gentlemen, I wanted to go to a lava tube, a cave, to do Mars research. I did not ask to find myself in the middle of Bigfoot country, and not just Bigfoot, violent, brutally violent, dangerous Bigfoot country, okay? I did not ask to be there, but I found it. It drew me to there. I was pulled towards there, and then I was pulled into the cavern. Next thing you know, it keeps pulling me back in.
Listen, this is easily the biggest confluence of weird things activity we have ever had on this show. And I want to let everybody know that if you have enjoyed Andrew's tale of daring do, then you could continue.
You could fund these expeditions.
Exactly. If you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, that is where we, with the 417 patrons, are well on our way to our goal of $1,000 an episode. Thank you guys so much for helping us out with this. It is super huge, and it has totally allowed us to take this show to another level. Thanks to Bryce, our producer and everything, which we have already brought on. Thanks to you. He actually got paid, which is really rad. So thank you very, very much. And thank you to everybody who's done it. Thank you to anybody who's going to do it after listening to this, which I think you should. I mean, listen, if anyone's going to peel a few pennies out of your pocket, then this is the time to do it after listening to Andrew's amazing adventure.
Harrowing tale of what might have been.
Just glad I'm here, guys. Just glad I'm here to tell you the story. Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Yo.
I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm. Shoot.
What's the closest star to, I was about to say, to the United States, besides the sun, what's the closest star to planet Earth?
Same diff.
Yeah, to United, let's call it like we see it, the United States. That's what we care about. You mean which is the first to be annexed under the United States eminent domain?
What's the closest star?
Proxima Centauri, right?
All right, so you say. Let me ask you a question. During Julius Caesar's time, what was the closest star?
Oh, shoot. I don't know. Is it Alpha Centauri?
It's probably Proxima Centauri.
Okay.
During Neanderthal times, maybe just even 70,000 years ago, what was the closest star?
I'm going to say Proxima Centauri.
Well, you would be wrong.
Damn me.
You would be wrong. An international team of astronomers, that makes it so much better, guys. one of them was Canadian, you know. An international team of astronomers identified a star that passed through, this is from Io9, passed through the outer reaches of the Oort cloud some 70,000 years ago. It came within a distance of 0.8 light years, making it the closest known flyby of a star to the solar system. Technically, if you're flying through the Oort cloud, which is part of our solar system,
yeah, briefly, we were a binary star system?
Well, they weren't in a gravitational lock, so technically it wouldn't be a binary. But it's called Schultz's star. I know not, Jane. It's part of a binary system. Its companion is a brown dwarf, kind of a failed star, reminiscent of a failed star. You know what?
Yeah.
Can we focus on what they have done, what they haven't done?
Personally, I am not a fan of star shaming.
Starship.
So it came within 52,000 AU, that's astronomical units, to the sun, or 0.8 light years, that's 5 trillion miles. Extremely close.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't realize, in 70,000 years sounds like yesterday. That's amazing.
Yeah. So it may have, it was too dim to be seen, but it may be because it was magnetically active, it might have flared up. And it's now 20 light years away. But just, you know, the idea of thinking that everything is sort of fixed in place, it's not. There's another rogue star. This is HIP 85605. Will come close to our solar system about 240,000 years. And it won't come any closer than 200 light years now. So that's not really that close. There's plenty of stars closer to that. That's it's a reminder that the galaxy is moving. Things are an object. Things are moving back and forth. We talked about previously about how there may have been a you know, there may be still out there Earth-sized planets within our solar system, but way the heck out there that, you know, some scientists, some astronomers think that fit the calculations.
I'm sorry, Earth-sized planets?
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, on this planet, presumably, we're going to say most likely without atmosphere anything like ours, but certainly gravity close to ours. So if we were on this planet, what would it look and feel like? We probably would not have much of an atmosphere, if any, so you'd be wearing a spacesuit, but it would be a heavy, heavy spacesuit because you'd have Earth gravity. You would look up, you would see essentially a nighttime star field, but with one star, how bright? Like as bright as...
Maybe Jupiter bright, you know?
Really? Wow. So it's like not even Venus at sunset bright.
I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing. But here's the thing. You might be standing on ice, and underneath that ice, there could be water, and there could be a thermally active ocean. And right. There could be life.
With swimming around things. And to these critters, even if they, you know, it's, now we talked about this, right? You know, what are the odds of an underwater creature bothering to, or having any advantage to develop intelligence? I guess probably about the same as on Earth since, and it could be, you know, it has been debated that dolphins and whales are smart. Do you think they're as smart as humans?
Well, I think what we've talked about in the past has been their ability to keep history, right? Like that being a defining element of our civilization is that we are able to build on our past beyond what our natural intelligence is and what separates us from other, you know, animals on this planet, and whether or not they would be able to do something like that.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, we've talked about this before a lot. Is it 30,000, 40,000 years ago? There were half a dozen different hominids walking around on Earth, and we were just one of them. Neanderthals, Denisovians, Red Deer Cave people, Homo forensis, there were many descendants of Homo erectus and offshoots, things like that. And we don't know what went extinct. And this is an important thing to remember. Up until about 10 years ago, just 10 years ago, this century, there was no fossil record for chimpanzees.
This is just because, you're saying they weren't old enough to be fossilized.
No, they just didn't live in regions where they could be fossilized.
Got it.
They lived in very heavy marsh environments. So we hadn't found any fossils for chimpanzees. Every fossil that we have right now of a chimpanzee going back, you know, more than a few hundred years or whatever, fits in a shoebox.
Wow.
That's insane.
And we can genetically, we can look and we can see that we can, and we understand when we look at the regions at which they came from or they're around, these are environments, they're humid, jungle-like environments that just don't encourage fossilization. Things, if you die, things eat you, scatter you, whatever. They're not living in environments where you're able to find it. So we don't know. You only find fossils in environments that are really good for creating fossils. Fossils are the exception, not the norm. So when it comes to human ancestors, we found traces of 6 or 7. I guarantee you, I promise you, as far as distinct species, there was probably three times as many or more different kinds of separate groups that we will only know about when we start. We only know about it if we find that they've interbred with us and we can find it in our DNA. And that's what's been happening is we go look into our DNA for the most part. Either we find fragments, we find DNA in there, or we look into our DNA and we see that, man, this thing came from some group. We don't know where and when, but this just popped out of nowhere.
Man. So. How far back does recorded history go? Like 10,000 years? Is that about right? Or,
I mean, it depends on how you define, like as far as like written language and like, you know, this happened to this happened and this happened, you know, it's a few thousand years, you know, it's once once you get pre-Babylonian and stuff, there's just, you know, there's a lot of myths and things like that in the oral histories we know, but it's harder to find. But we have the oldest, you know, the oldest structure we know of now that predates everything, and it's a recent discovery that is only getting you know, more attention now, is Göbekli Tepe, okay, and that's in Turkey, and this is a region that dates back 12,000 years, okay, the 10th millennia BCE, okay, and it was abandoned. It goes back 12,000 years ago. It was abandoned 10,000 years ago.
Holy cow.
Okay. And we've only uncovered a tiny small part of it, and we find massive stones there. And this was an environment that was radically different. When this thing was built, Doggerland, that region between England and France, which is now underneath the water, underneath the channel, was above ground, was a fertile area in which people lived and thrived. You can actually have your DNA. Like I check, I have DNA that probably goes back to the people who lived in Doggerland, as do many people. You know, and that's an entirely gone region that would inspire one of the many Atlantean sort of myths. So these people were even prior to Doggerland going under. They were around probably 3,000 or 4,000 years, and then their, you know, environment changed. But this could have been a very fertile effort area. This predates any of the Middle Eastern settlements we know of. Of course, those things are built on top of each other.
I mean, I guess the reason I was asking how far back our history extends is because it utterly fascinates me, and I find it so remarkable that given the trajectory that we may be on, where for the next thousands and thousands of years we leave Earth and we expand forever and ever and ever, essentially, just as I think Twitter is a remarkable tool in that it's the – when Twitter started, the world started keeping a diary. You know, we have this record of everything people were chit-chatting about, and everything before Twitter is going to be kind of a black hole or whatever eventually comes to supplant Twitter.
Let me just run for a second. There are structures here that weigh 20 tons, that weigh 20-ton stone things that were erected. They have done topographic scans there, and they found structures, built structures, 15,000 years old. And this is not some fringy Weekly World News thing. This is an emerging thing we're looking into. 15,000 years old, which is 10,000 years before we really had agriculture.
That's amazing. Well, and I guess so it's we talk about the ability to maintain one's history is so important, you know, especially, you know, to build on the knowledge of those who came before. I mean, essentially, to know that we are the generation where pretty much this level of fidelity moving forward begins, and that our words, even now as we speak this, have the possibility to survive as perfect as they are right now, you know, for 10,000 years is, I don't know, shocking.
We hope. But you have to think that 15,000 years ago, when they start to build these big, massive stone structures that were unparalleled for, again, 15,000 years ago, they're building stone structures. Okay, and it's hard. I mean, Neanderthals, we think the last fragments of Neanderthals, we think maybe went extinct 30,000 years ago. That's the last time we found things that looked like their tools above the Arctic Circle, but that doesn't mean that they didn't last longer. And they could have reached, you know, there are, when you start reading reports and accounts of explorers from Alexander on forward, you find people going to areas of India and other places and encountering very strange people that could have been, not necessarily Neanderthals, other things like that, but 15,000 years ago, there may have been other hominids at that point.
Wow. That's insane. And
15,000 – I'm just thinking 15,000 years ago, here you are. You're building the structure. It's a massive – you know, it's a big complex. It's the biggest, most impressive thing anybody's ever seen. It's a high point of technology. If you lived near there or you're a part of that, you have to think, man, you know, we're kind of special. But guess what? After that decline, it was 10,000 years before anybody came close to that again.
Man,
that is insane to wrap your head around. And also, it's like, from what you said, like, this is, you know, so far before we know, you know, like, we assume agriculture, you know, the agriculture we know today is in practice, or the earliest forms of it, like, and yet they survived. Who knows what elements, you know, that we have since rediscovered that they had at the time, and it just was not something that carried on, you know, that they died out. What they did, you know, is something that we no longer have, and it's not recordable enough to know what they were doing to survive so long and so fruitfully.
We've only uncovered 5% of it.
Wow. Man, I don't know.
I'm just excited to base a fad diet around it as we discover more and more about how they survive.
Yes.
Understand. How do you think these guys lifted 20-ton blocks with their bare hands? Read my 7 secrets of diet to find out, and subscribe to my newsletter.
Gentlemen, do we want to do another weird thing, or do we want to go into picks? Yeah, I've got another weird thing for you, weird thing.
Dude, bring it. Let's go. Dive in.
We're going to go back to Mars for a moment.
Go ahead.
That's where I want
to. You know what I like about Mars?
What?
Everything. Mars is full of mystery.
It's great. It's great.
A couple days ago, recently on Mars, something happened.
Oh, wait a minute. I saw this. The headline, and of course, you know, headlines have a tendency to overstate things, but like the mysterious plume on Mars that nobody knows what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Is this right?
That's it.
So what is the story about it?
Well, you know, on This Is Fizz org that came from Cloud Over Mars, the scientist baffled. Same. So they found we've imaged plumes on Mars that are like over 250 kilometers tall. Okay. Now, what is it? What are these plumes? What are they? We don't know. We have theories on these things, and it's not like scientists are completely like, I give up, guys. You know, I became, you know, an astronomer. Astrophysicist. I became an astronomer because I wanted certainty, you know. But no, I mean, it's like, they have theories and ideas. We don't know. But we know that, you know.
But just to go back to the headline, I just love, like, leave scientists baffled. Oh, as dude. If, like.
That's fizz.org, too, though. Like, you know. And everybody else in the internet age, like, okay, they said baffled. We'll use stumped.
Right. Well,
leave science with their thumbs up their butts going, what happened?
Exactly. Like, I don't know. I have no idea.
They're running around the hall.
Like they're all waving handkerchiefs around like, you know, like, I have no idea.
Man, you're so right. There's this weird smugness to all of these headlines. Scientists can't explain massive Martian plume in your face, scientists. Mysterious Mars plumes defy explanation. Mystery Mars plume baffles scientists. Mars plumes. Why the low resolution? Nobody knows.
That actually might be the most relevant headline, by the way. Like, at least it's like, hey, look, like it's hard to look at what this is, you know, which might cause the mystery. Anyway, sorry, Andrew, go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, I think that, I mean, again, and this is one of those things that for scientists, or it's like, they're like, goody, this is awesome. They're excited because it's like, you know, this is they're not like going, ah, God, everything I know has failed. It's like, this is why you become a scientist, is for these types of things. And we have theories and stuff, but we don't know. And there's a lot of things on the surface of Mars that we have rough estimates of what caused them. And then we have disagreement. You know, we've talked about before, there's, you know, one, you know, we have a microbiologist, geologist who looks at some structures says, nope, this is caused by microbes. Another one's like, no. You get those, you've seen those weird spider crystals that form in the southern hemisphere.
No. Wait, spider
crystals? Type Mars spiders.
Crystals Mars. All right. Spider crystals Mars. I definitely got a video game.
No, not spider crystals. Just type Mars and I think Mars spiders.
Mars spiders. Let's see. Oh, wow. Are you talking about these right here?
Yep.
What are those?
They're aliens, Brian.
I know. I mean, they look like, I guess they're crystals, natural formations.
CO2, you know, with CO2 burgeoning from the surface. But when you talk about what's cool about exploring Mars is, what are these things?
Yeah, dude. I don't have any sense of scale from this. If you showed me this picture, it could be from a mile up or it could be with an electron microscope. I honestly have no sense.
Yeah, these things are hundreds of meters across.
Okay, so this is high, high up then.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes me feel better, strangely.
Yeah. So.
Otherwise, I mean, this could be just a close-up of my pockmarked skin when I was a teenager.
Yes.
So, another one of those little, you know, we have, again, there are theories, there are explanations to what these things could be. Whether or not we're right, we don't know. Till we go there, we send more probes there. We don't know.
So, this is just out there in the world. We don't quite know what the hell is happening, and we'll figure it out as we go along.
I mean, that looks like that plume could be, if you have... Mars has tons of frozen CO2. There's water and has tons of frozen CO2. And it has volcanoes. We assume the volcanoes are long extinct, long dormant, that all that tectonic activity shut down. Maybe not. Maybe it has. But you might have vast caverns of CO2 that might all of a sudden start to heat up and then might expel, you know, and just create a little fissure. Then all of a sudden you have this outpouring of CO2 that rushes out there. And you've got to think that something that can shoot, you know, that much of a spurt 250 kilometers in the sky... You know, is it a CO2 volcano? These are things we don't have on Earth. What do we compare them to? A geyser? You know, so that's the beautiful thing is that Mars is similar and it's alien.
Or, of course. All right.
You guys want to do picks?
Let's do picks.
Man, can we all just agree? Can we take a moment to geek out over Better Call Saul? Are we all watching that?
I haven't catched the last episode, but yeah, I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that'll be my pick then. You know, I'll say Better Call Saul.
I'll take your pick, Brian.
Well, I mean, I don't know, because we had this conversation that I think like we are both excited. I am probably more excited than Brian.
Yes.
At this point in the story, but the third episode, to me, what makes me excited is the exponential growth of storytelling and character possibility that continues to happen episode by episode, and where that trajectory is, and knowing that I have faith in these storytellers from Breaking Bad, I guess that's what really, really makes me excited, is that the third episode just takes those character elements where now everybody that you've met continues to become more interesting, more nuanced, you know, can go in different directions. You've now got six or seven people that all could take you in different areas, and all of them would be interesting and fun. And we continue to see this weird fun house mirror, you know, a story that is paralleled on some levels with the Walter White kind of descent into darkness that we saw in Breaking Bad. And with Jimmy McGill, we see somebody who is certainly not, well, I guess maybe more transparently flawed at the beginning, but who maybe have more of a pure heart at the beginning of the story than we kind of learn to know Walter White as. So
that, yeah, I can say that's one of the things I appreciated about it. I took me a while to get into Breaking Bad because it was clear to me when I started watching, oh, he's a bad guy. He's a guy that wants an excuse to do – he's between doing good or bad, he's going to choose bad because he's angry at the world and these things.
He spent so much time being powerless and –
yeah, that Vince Gilligan – and I didn't know that Vince Gilligan really intended that. I just thought it was just – you know, at first I'm like, wow, do the writers realize that – Their anti-hero here is more anti than hero. And then once Andrew, we got this, you know. Yeah. And then I go, oh, this is exceptional. Now I will forgive a lot of where it's hard for me to relate to him, because now I understand. Whereas Better Call Saul, it's sort of he really is in many ways trying to be a good guy, but he keeps putting himself in these bad situations, and he's addicted to the power that he has when he's in these horrible situations.
And that continues. He just it's one thing after another of like just these specific to his failings, you know, these things that happen, which are really great. And also, you know, I've never been this excited for any kind of prequel story ever.
Well, but I mean, again, here's the secret to running good prequels. Is to tell new stories that just happen to be set in the same universe. And the fact, which by the way, it's an interesting situation because you could kind of tell what year it is by the phones. Like phones have become this cultural touchstone that immediately clue you into whether it's the early 90s, the late 90s, the early 2000s or modern day. And
certainly over the last 30 years, you can immediately set a scene based on the phone that somebody pulls out of their pocket or picks up.
Yeah. But I mean, like seeing the scene when his brother comes to visit Jimmy in prison, you know,
spoiler alert.
Oh, well, I mean, it's okay. It's a brief set piece, but regardless, it clearly takes place like in the late 80s, early 90s.
Well, it's the first scene of the show. And the first shot you have is of a gigantic brick phone.
Yeah.
Which is like, it just immediately tells you, all right, like we are in a certain point, which is so funny that now that we're in 2014, it is different than these scenes, which is modern day for our story of Better Call Saul, where people are using super crappy flip camera phones,
right?
Because it is further along, and now we are so far into the modern smartphone revolution that that looks like that immediately puts us into a certain point in time.
Yeah. It's great to see vectors emerging that, you know, one of the things that was awesome about Breaking Bad and The Shield was having these kind of nested problems within problems. And you knew you can't go to this person because of this. But, you know, and as we're getting more of this backstory and we're starting to hear, you know, I don't know, some of the backstory on Mike, Irma Trout and whatever, you know. him being caught in a little lie that causes him to deal with Nacho in a certain way. And I don't know, you start to see those threads coming. You start to see the landscape of what we're going to see over the next however many seasons.
And I think it's so fun to see maybe the best people working in television today at suspense storytelling with Breaking Bad, which became, you know, it elevated that to such a gigantic level. You know, like we never, you know, you look at other, like, you know, The Wire, The Sopranos or something like that. Like there were rich, complex ideas that I think and characters that carried those, you know, probably characters with The Sopranos and storytelling or with The Wire. But none of them had the, like, tear your heart out of your chest suspense that Breaking Bad had. And it's like when you realize they're still in their prime and they're still telling these kinds of stories and they can just so effortlessly kind of turn this knob and show like somebody's face or reaction or put people in a certain sense where you're like, oh my God, like I am just preparing myself to be suffocated by this. It's great and everybody should watch it.
Yeah. We also, I guess we talked a bit about Better Call Saul last week. We had already talked about Bold as well, right, Andrew? Mm-hmm. Are you continuing to read Bold?
Finished Bold.
And how were you left with it?
I thought it was very bold.
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 A1 bold.
No, I think I highly recommend it. I think I really encouraged it. You know, I have my little, you know, my minor nitpicks, but it's more like, you should put this on the wall here. It's a beautiful house you have here, you know.
Right.
But you put the carpet on the ceiling. But other than that, no. it's great. Yes.
Right on. All right. I guess my pick is going to be. I'm doing a bunch of the great courses, and I just finished Behavioral Economics by Professor Scott Huitel, which is about the. A lot of it will be familiar territory if you've listened to a lot of Radiolab or, you know, read a lot of Freakonomics stuff or listened to the Freakonomics podcast or even read, Dr. Paul Zak's book about oxytocin. But, you know, it's the psychology of you know, the dictator game of the what's the one where it's like you decide how much money gets played? The ultimatum game, a bunch of, I don't know, these a lot of game theory in there that's really interesting. And now I moved on to Professor Stephen Novella's course, which is Your Deceptive Mind, a scientific guide to the neuroscience of your brain and how you trick yourself, of critical thinking skills. That's what it is. And I'm enjoying that quite a bit as well.
All right. My pick is a book. It's also an audiobook. It's called Bold. And it's by Peter Diamandis, written with Stephen Kotler, who narrates the audiobook. And Brian and I have talked about this before. And by the way, I'm in the middle of started in Abundance. And Abundance to me, I highly recommend Abundance, but Abundance could be, if you've read in a certain area of stuff, it could be a summation of everything else you've read. And you're like, yep, remember when they wrote that and I said that in that book? Yep, remember when he said that in that book? Yep, remember when he said that in that book? But it's still a really good, you know, good listener, good read. But Bold is, you know, Bold as they took those ideas in Abundance, the idea that we're living in an exponential future. Things are just radically getting cheaper. Things are falling in prices. And there are problems to be solved in this world. But these problems are going to be solved with the tools that we have at hand around us that we just have to see what they are and understand how the world works. I think it's absolutely a very inspiring and exciting book to read, either if you were somebody looking to start a business or somebody who just wanted to understand how rapidly and how quickly things are changing. And there is among, I would say that starting from the tech industry and people in software in particular, emanating outwards, there is this wave of optimism that is unprecedented, that is just maybe not since the 1950s have there's been a group of people that are so outwardly optimistic about where things are going, and other people are just not quite getting it, understanding it, but these optimists are billionaires, and they're people who are doing amazing things. When the world's largest advertising company is building robotic cars and investing in outer space projects, i.e. Google, that's pretty incredible. When you have the guy who is the, you know, the number one retailer in the world has created a company that is now a competitor for sending astronauts into objects into space, Jeff Bezos, it's pretty optimistic and amazing to think about that, that the three of the biggest tech companies in the world are heavily invested in space exploration, that in materials manufacturing, that this is the world we live in now. It's exciting. You know, now Apple is 5 years away from maybe releasing a car.
It's insane. What's the part that really stuck with me is the very pragmatic, straight-faced, serious, practical advice of if you are going to build a business, make sure you build your business plan right now, assuming that that computational power is infinite and free, that bandwidth is infinite and free, that storage is infinite and free. And now we're entering a world where creative problem-solving power is becoming infinite and free, or at least trending in that direction, which is unreal.
And to give you an idea of how these things are changing so rapidly, like right now, you can go to Tinkercad, which I talked about before, Tinkercad, and you can start designing. It's a wonderful, wonderful environment for doing three-dimensional design if you want to create 3D products to make. Within Tinkercad, once you've made your little gadget or your headset or whatever you want to make, there's a button you press that will then allow you to choose from one of four companies that will then make it and send it to you. And, you know, to have them send you a prototype or whatever on one hand might seem, you know, it's not competitive with something you would just buy from Amazon, but it is extremely competitive compared to what it would have cost years ago to have somebody send you a prototype.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really comparatively cheap. Those prices are going to continue to fall. You're already getting right now, there are a bunch of different, there's MakeXYZ, for example, which is a company that you can upload your file to and they'll find somebody locally and give you a quote to have them make between 1 and 20 copies of something. It ends up being pretty inexpensive. Those prices of manufacturing are going to fall because 3D printers are falling and materials are falling and they're becoming more redundant. You're going to get to the point very, very soon that, you know, you're not going to – when the problem with Kickstarter, often many Kickstarter projects fail because they have a great idea. They prototype it, works. Then they go to China to have it built, and they're totally inexperienced with how to get things done in China. And part of the reason is that, you know, 5% of the companies there make wonderful stuff. 95% of them do not. And every one of them will give you a great first one off the line that you think looks great. But when you look at the next 1,000, you realize they're not. And it's a manufacturing issue. But any event, trying to deal with any kind of overseas manufacturer is problematic. And when many of the Kickstarter projects have to deal with that. But you're getting to a point soon enough where the 3D prototype or the 3D prototyping devices will be able to make stuff that you can mass produce inexpensively. People are putting together farms of MakerBots, of replicators, all of a sudden, and they're in cities. I mean, there's a dozen of them near me in LA, and there's several around here where I am right now where you can just say, hey, maybe let me go send this to you and I'll come over tomorrow afternoon and I'll pick up a bunch of these manufactured items. So it's not just, you know, information stuff that's becoming this way. Manufactured items are becoming rapidly easier to produce, and we're going to live in a world that's a radically different kind of thing. When you order something from Amazon and you either print it yourself, or if it's a little bit more higher fidelity item, maybe, you know, there's a replication facility a mile away that produces it in an hour.
That's the strange paradox when you think about, like, if you, let's say you're a small business entrepreneur and you realize, oh my gosh, if I get a 3D printer, then I can print things and sell it. And it'll be awesome because I can make a whole bunch of things and then sell them and make money. But then you realize in a world where you have a 3D printer, everyone else has a 3D printer, and who are you going to sell it to? And why would they buy? Their question becomes like, why do I not just print it myself?
But I mean, I think that the thing is that the way we're going to measure, you know, why don't you just do Google yourself? You know, why don't you do that? Because you can't. Because right. To make that work, you need to have 1,000 computers to work. And to make a, you know, right now you can make drinking cups, spoons, and simple sort of things. You can't make an iPhone with a 3D printer. 5 years from now, you might be able to make today's current iPhone with a 3D printer, but you're not going to produce, you know, the microprocessor that's 1,000 times more powerful with an over-the-counter desktop 3D printer. You're going to still need $1 million machine because the precision levels will get there. So we're going to go for all this low-hanging fruit like we do in overseas. There are certain things you don't buy. Let's say, like, you know, China isn't known for necessarily, let's say, jet engine parts or certain kinds of, you know, computer components, because you need to go to Korea or Japan for those because they have the proficiency and the tooling to be able to do that, and it takes certain kinds of tolerances. So yeah, there will be, like, if you're making stuff that anybody can make, yeah, why why do it when somebody can make it? So you have to keep kind of making these things.
I guess that's what I'm heading. I'm hinting at is that there's this kind of constant, trading up the chain. This complexity where it's like mm-hmm. you got to stay one step ahead if you want to make mm-hmm. a buck.
Yeah, if I wanted to build like a 3D replicating factory right now, I've been talking about this, all weekend, is the idea that I would design it. I would try to amortize everything over 2 years, assuming every 2 years you'd need to swap out your 3D printers for the next gen one, because in 2 years' time, it'll be easily, what you can buy at home, whatever. But, I agree.
Yeah,
gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.